I want to use my experiences with this work to come up with a general playbook for if there is a virus that you want to neutralize, this is a way to do so. These are the different steps using protein design, using these publicly available tools that we can take to make a really potent drug that can prevent that virus from causing a really gnarly disease.
Welcome to the Baker Lab Podcast. I'm Ian Hayden.
And I'm David Baker, the director of the UW Institute for Protein Design. Today we'll be hearing from Jeremiah Sims, who goes by Jeremy. Jeremy has a deep interest not only in science, but also in medicine, and he's pursuing a dual PhD and MD degree.
That is not easy. As a trainee in David's lab, Jeremy is developing antivirals against some pretty scary viruses. But that's not the only thing he's interested in.
Science is really a collective effort, and Jeremy's been an amazing communicator in the lab. And in this episode, Jeremy highlights the importance of community, both within science and outside.
So that is where I started our conversation with Jeremy. I asked him about his science and how it might affect communities.
In my opinion, it's not an exaggeration to say that your research could end up saving millions of lives. It's also true that I hope your work is never needed.
Me too.
So in the first half of this episode, we're going to explain why that's the case and get into your current research, which focuses on creating new antiviral proteins for some of the world's most dangerous pathogens. Where does that story start?
Yeah, I think it starts in a couple different places. When I was starting to get into research at Yale, I was working with this mentor, Elsie Yen. She is awesome, like really, really supportive. And that's where I like kind of pivoted from like chemistry into like thinking about like chemical biology, basically like the idea of can we use chemical principles to manipulate biology and make safer and better drugs for folks. And then after that, I started thinking about what application areas I would get into. And that led me to working with Dr. Sanjay Desai at the NIH, where I was studying how malaria gets nutrients. And once I got to my MD PhD and realized I wanted to do protein design, I knew for a fact that I wanted to do something in the infectious disease space. When the pandemic hit and David was pitching me project ideas, he had mentioned this project idea and antivirals, and I just knew immediately, like, that's exactly what I want to do, even if it's not going to garner the most funding or attention, like channeling this like next generation technology to something that feels important, that impacts predominantly Black and brown folks, was something that I knew I had to get into.
Awesome. So let's talk about viruses. So I think when most people think about dangerous viruses or even deadly viruses, they probably think of like COVID.
For sure.
And, you know, flu's still around and actually does kill a lot of people each year.
For sure.
You work on some different viruses than that, ones mm-hmm. that I actually think most people haven't even heard of. Can yep. you tell me about those?
Yeah. So right now I'm focusing in on the Nipah viruses, Nipah, Hendra, and other members of that viral family. They're in the same like overall viral family as measles, mumps, RSV, croup. So things that we have heard of.
I've heard of some of those.
But perhaps the reason we haven't really heard of this class of viruses is because they have been popping up in like cyclical outbreaks in rural farmlands in India, Bangladesh, for the Hendra virus in Australia, et cetera. So, and these outbreaks tend to be like quite limited. You know, fewer than 50 people are affected at a given time, but they're really lethal. Case fatality rates range from 40 to 100%.
40 to 100% lethality. That's crazy.
Like insane.
That means that this is no joke.
Yes.
This is not like getting a little bit of a flu. Like this could kill you. These are
Absolutely.
Serious viruses, even though I haven't heard much about them.
Yeah.
Should I understand this though? Is like, it's really serious for those individuals who might be in one of these you know, fairly contained outbreaks. Is that the risk we're talking about here, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of both, right? You know, we run the risk of having these outbreaks spiral into something bigger. The way it presents is like a flu or a cold or something. You could very easily hop on a plane, hop on a bus, and pass that to a bunch of people. The unfortunate thing is this will progress into, a infection of your brain and such. You get a brain inflammation, encephalitis, and then you die. So if we've been lucky as a species that these outbreaks have been really contained.
All right. Now I'm worried.
Yep.
What are we doing about this? What are you doing about this?
I'm not trying to fearmonger. There are a lot of really cool ways to go about this. There's a lot of tools in the pandemic toolbox. We saw masks were super effective. Restricting the mobility of certain populations during the infectious time period. One of the things that I'm working on in this lab is coming up with very stable and scalable drugs using proteins, which are kind of nature's biological Legos.
That's super interesting. So walk me through that real quick. So there's a Nipah virus.
Yep.
Somebody on the bus has it and I'm sitting next to him.
Yeah.
They cough.
Yep.
What's going to happen?
So that virus will spread through respiratory droplets. If you accidentally breathe it in through your nose or your mouth, it gets to a lung tissue. And then with some frequency, it will bind to a cell. It will enter that cell. It will dump its viral, like genetic cargo, and it will make more copies of that virus. So the only way that a virus can replicate is by attaching to a host cell and fusing or being able to open up its viral cage, its capsid, to dump its cargo. And so basically the goal is to block one or both of those mechanisms, attachment and fusion.
So attachment and fusion. I think I've heard attachment described as a handshake.
Yeah.
It's the virus and you, your cells, mm-hmm. somehow have this ill-fated handshake.
Exactly.
And that's what sort of kickstarts the whole process, the Indeed. Sickness, and in some cases, death. So the molecules that you're making, that you're designing, one of the ways they can work is they, mess up that handshake?
Yeah, they essentially block the handshake. It's like if the virus needs to shake hands with one person in this room in order to cause like a massive disease, it's like you start flooding the virus with a bunch of decoy hands, these fake prop hands. And if the virus, if you can lock in a fake handshake with the virus, then it can't make the one handshake that it needs to make.
Now we have these software tools that let us try to come up with whatever new proteins we want. Mm-hmm. So you're making that decoy hand.
Exactly.
It's going to recognize what it's looking for. It's not going to grab my proteins. It's not going to grab some other thing that might be beneficial.
Correct.
My gut microbiome.
That's one of our major concerns when we're actually making these proteins. One of the nice things about the decoy approach is that we're actually taking part of the real hand that the virus is trying to shake.
The human protein.
We're taking a part of it such that the virus will say, hey, this actually is a real hand. And we think that by preserving the native hand structure, we can prevent the virus from mutating away and escaping our receptor decoy, because any time that it makes a mutation away from our decoy, it also is making a mutation away from the hand that it actually wants to shake.
So you want the decoy to look like me. That makes it a good decoy.
Mm-hmm.
Grip it really tight.
Mm-hmm.
But then you're saying, you know, this could help for things like resistance to these antivirals. Because if it evolves in such a way, if the virus changes in such a way where it doesn't care about the decoy anymore, that's not so good for it, because it's going to lose sight of my real hand too.
Exactly. Because we've molded them to be almost identical.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say in a perfect world, I hear your lab results are actually going pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you've made these decoys.
Yep.
And these other types of antiviral proteins that have a different mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
What is that going to do for the world? What is this research hopefully going to let us do?
Yeah. So I have kind of two goals, like, for this research, for the specific Nipah virus project, I'm hoping that by focusing on making these receptor decoys as manufacturable as possible and as stable as possible, that they can be like taken forward through the drug development pipeline, that they can actually be tested on the ground as Nipah virus outbreaks happen every single year. The second thing, the second aim for this work is to really flesh out a general strategy for any virus with pandemic potential. You know, like I mentioned earlier, every virus kind of works similarly in that they need to attach to their host cell, and then they need to fuse to dump their genetic material inside of the host cell. And so I want to use my experiences with this work to come up with a general playbook for if there is a virus that you want to neutralize, this is a way to do so. These are the different steps using protein design, using these publicly available tools that we can take to make a really potent drug that can prevent that virus from causing a really gnarly disease.
What does a normal day in the lab look like for you?
I wake up, I head to lab, I get some coffee, like sip on a latte, and then I immediately start hooping. I immediately put the headphones in and I'm cooking like 6 experiments. I like doing a lot of things at once. Like that's just, I do not recommend it for most other people because it's such a chaotic, a hectic way to go about it, but I know exactly what experiments I'm doing every single day. I'm excited about them. I test them. I got my headphones in. I hit the centrifuge. I'm dancing. Like, I'm listening to music, having a good time. I'm chit-chatting with people. You know, grab some food when I can fit it in between experiments. Because I don't plan out my day that well where I factor in the basic things that I need. But yeah, I finish up around probably sometime between 5 and 8. And like as the day starts winding down, like, you know, I start winding down, like chit-chatting with folks on the phone, blah blah blah, analyze my data, plot out the next experiments. Yeah, I'd say that's a typical day in lab.
I bet our listeners know the guy who runs the lab that you're in, David Baker, just won a Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
We're actually recording this in October. The mm-hmm. prize was announced about 2 weeks ago. Nobel Prizes are a pretty big deal. I'm curious, how did you hear the news and what did it mean to you?
Yeah, I heard the news because all of my friends kept blowing up my phone. And I was like, why is my phone going off at 7 a.m.? Like, what's going on? And I flipped my phone over and my jaw dropped. I expected it to happen. I've been telling people like, hey, he's in line to win the Nobel Prize. I just didn't think it was going to happen for like another 10 years or so. So yeah, I don't know. I found out, I texted everybody. I called a bunch of people who were calling me and it just felt like a really cool, confirmatory moment that like maybe I am in the right place, and it just so happens to be the right time.
That's really cool. I bet probably our listeners are curious, like, what's it been like here working in the Baker lab? What happens when your boss wins a Nobel Prize?
Oh my god, the first thing you do is party, baby. Yeah, so we got to lab and the lab was buzzing, media folks around. Our lab is huge, like, you know, upwards of 100 people. So almost everybody was there. And the atmosphere was just like so light and happy. You know, we like doing experiments in the lab. Almost every experiment was on hold that day. The lab was like really decorated. People were just in full on celebration mode. And in the afternoon, we went out to the courtyard and no, you know, it wasn't just our lab, like people from all over the UW research community and the larger Seattle biotech and research community showed up just to like kind of take part in the moment. it was one of, honestly, it was one of my favorite days of the lab, not because, you know, there was champagne flowing and pizza readily available, but because, you know, people were just like here to celebrate what an awesome accomplishment it was with a, you know, a really fun group of people. It's always cool to celebrate the big man as well. Like, he's a cool guy.
Awesome. All right. I'm going to switch gears a little bit.
Cool.
So going all the way back, tell me about where you're from,
mm-hmm.
and what kind of student you were. I would love to know what drew you into science.
Yeah. So I'm from Richmond, Virginia. I grew up in Richmond, like in a, like a pretty strong black community. And, you know, my parents sent me to Christian school. I was a super nerd growing up. Like, I still say I'm a super nerd, but like, I don't know, it felt derogatory, like more so back then. And I was just like, I enjoyed school. Like, I enjoyed learning. My mom read to me growing up, like when I was a kid. So yeah, I don't know. My parents have always described me as somebody who just like really enjoyed learning and like never really struggled academically. You know, as I got older, like switched schools, I started getting a little bit more specialized. You know, once I got that C in reading in fifth grade, I was like, maybe, you know, maybe reading isn't my jam. But yeah, science and math have always been something that, like, at least like in grade school, came supernaturally to me. So it was like always something that I was like excited about. Then I got to Yale and, yeah, just like gravitated towards chemistry after having a really great chemistry teacher, Susan Fornes. Yeah, she was awesome.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out to Professor Fornes.
Do you remember? So I know a lot of people don't love chemistry.
Yeah.
What about it spoke to you? What was interesting about it to you?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely the first time scientifically that I felt like I'd ever been challenged. Especially in AP chemistry, I was like, oh, whoa, this is like a completely different way of thinking. So that was super fun. And then like our AP chemistry class was like really small, like really tight. And once we got to like actually like physically mix solutions and then study how those solutions got mixed and like the effects of that happening and used math to do so, I was like, yep, that's the one. I'm locked in. Had a little bit of the same interest in AP bio, but chemistry was really like, chemistry was the one for me at the time.
I've also heard you say you've had a challenging early life.
Mm-hmm.
Are you comfortable talking about that?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I'm a pretty open book. Yeah, I don't know. I think like things were really, I think things were really good for me when my parents were together. You know, things don't work out, blah, blah, blah. My parents got divorced when I was around 7 or 8. And with that came like, you know, a lot of, just like a lot of moving around. There was a lot of fighting and then like a lot of financial struggles, a lot of which my parents like did well to shield from me and my sister when we were growing up. Like as like little kids, but became very, very, very clear, like throughout that divorce process and afterwards. Shouts out to them. They still like worked super hard to make sure that me and my sister could have as many opportunities as possible, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, spent some time living in my grandma's house in Church Hill, which like was a big change for me growing up on the East End, moving into the inner city, and then being completely separated from like my friend groups growing up. Just like there's like a massive like de-identification process that I didn't really like reconcile until way later. And then going to this, like I ended up getting like a scholarship to this like very wealthy white private high school or middle school or high school called Collegiate. Terrible place for me. I will not shout them out. Like, I'm sorry, guys. You guys made my life miserable. Especially the students there. Super racist. like, yeah, they really did a number on like black folks there, especially low income black folks. Luckily I met my best friend in the world there, Devontae, and he's been my rock, because we grew up very similarly. And, you know, yeah, just being in Richmond at that time, like, and being in this particular environment, going through puberty, learning about myself, blah, 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 while being treated as a second class citizen was like definitely not great for the confidence. So I think, trying to discover my own self, both as like, well, less as a scientist, because I wasn't even thinking about myself as a scientist, but just like trying to discover myself at that time in these very conflicting environments was challenging. It was incredibly challenging. And yeah, it was rough considering that our experiences with like race and class were ignored or oftentimes like we were gaslit into thinking that they weren't actually there. And we've all recognized like, hey, like these common experiences actually were there.
If you were starting over in school or in your career, knowing what you know now, is there anything you'd do differently?
I think if I knew what I knew now, I probably would not be doing what I'm doing now. Yeah, I think I would have carried myself a lot differently. Like as I was growing up, I think I would have had a lot more confidence in myself. You know, I probably would have ended up at a different school. I still probably would have done really well in school, but I think like me being very timid growing up and me taking a backseat in many ways, and interpersonal dynamics, like in many ways led me to like going to Yale, where I ended up like blossoming in this particular trajectory, but I think I could have blossomed along a lot of different trajectories. So I don't know. It's like from this position, it's very hard to say if I would do something differently, but I probably would have behaved very differently. I probably wouldn't have taken as much crap growing up. And I think that would have probably shifted my trajectory.
That's an interesting answer to a difficult hypothetical.
For sure.
I've also heard you say that success can be a burden. Does that sound familiar?
No, but I mean, I probably said that. I believe that.
How would you put it?
I don't think anybody will ever feel sorry for anybody like experiencing success. And I do not want a single person listening to this to be like, oh my God, he's like lamenting his, nah, I'm not. I'm super not. I'm very jazzed about what I'm doing. But I do think like the different positions that you have to put yourself in, especially like coming from like low income black backgrounds, like it can be hard to find success in particular areas. And if you want to say pursue science, you actually might have to leave home and go far. And, you know, I came all the way out here and scientifically things have been great, but like, you know, Seattle has been an incredibly challenging spot for me. And I think chasing that success is something that has necessarily like isolated me from like a lot of my communities back home. I'm more used to being in spots that are just more like more black. Seattle about 5% black, you know, place on the East Coast in the South, we talking 20, 30, 40% black cities. Like it just is different and it's way easier to like build black community in places where there's a higher frequency of black folks, where there's just more diverse black experiences. That's something that's important to me. Like, I don't know, being out here is crazy for this very reason. It's very difficult to build black communities when we're so dilute relative to the population. And that said, like the black communities that are here, like can be super robust. Like my neighbors is dope. Like folks in the Central District are really cool. I just met a lot of, like, even transplant. I met a lot of transplants here as well, from the South, whatever. And, it does feel like home away from home in many ways because of that just, like, shared, like, experience and dedication to just, like, being together. But, you know, I don't see this as my home. I recognize that science and medicine pulls folks around as well. And the next place that I go, like, I want to make sure that there is a higher frequency such that when I do have to build that community again, I want it to be way easier. And I just wanted to be around, like, folks that, like, understand, like, you know, my culture and, like, where I come from and the music I listen to and the food that I eat and, like, the things I like to talk about and all that, you know? Things that make life rich and that fill your cup at the end of a long day.
You brought up music. You make music, right?
Yeah, I mean, so I grew up playing guitar. Picked it up in the fifth grade to pick up girls. I didn't pick up no girls, but I did pick up the guitar and I, you know, stuck with it because it was just something that, like, very quickly brought me peace, especially amidst, like, a bunch of other things that I've already, like, briefly touched on earlier. Like, it was just, like, a time where I could actually relax. It also was, like, a really solid creative outlet for me. I was very lucky to have a couple different creative outlets growing up. I played a lot of soccer. So shout out to my parents for, like, allowing me to continue to pursue that. As I grew up and, you know, as things got tough. And once I got to Yale, I met one of my best friends. His name is JT Flowers, Portland-based artist, and just, like, phenomenal, like, friend and black dude. And yeah, he cool. But me and him started producing together freshman year at Yale. And our buddy Mac, who's a phenomenal producer in his own right and is stupid successful. He's the dude who produced that song Unforgettable by French Montana. He had, like, put us on to producing. So, like, me and JT really followed up with that. And I mean, to this day, I still, like, use Logic Pro and produce stuff and blah, blah, blah. You know, things have slowed down a little bit since the PhD, like, kicked in really and the NEPA stuff took off. But yeah, like, I love just making music with my friends. It's just something that, you know, brings me peace and makes me really excited and makes me continually engage with the creative world, which I think, like, echoes into, like, the creativity that's required for my science, the creativity that's required as I keep playing soccer, the creativity as I just engage with, you know, society around me.
What's something you like about being a scientist, and what is something you don't like about it?
I like that I get paid, not that much, unfortunately, but I get paid to do, like, to just think of stuff and try it out. That's cool. That's, like, really cool. That's very cool to me to be able to get paid to just, like, think and then execute on your thoughts. There's a lot of different fields where you can do that, but I think science is one of them. I think one of the things that I don't like is that science enriches for and rewards, like, terrible personality traits. I think that it is easy to be successful in science if you're very good at science, regardless of if you care about your colleagues and are trying to be a good person. I think that almost always it is advantageous to be a good person because you learn more, to interact with your colleagues and engage with your colleagues as friends and as collaborators instead of adversaries or competitors. But because of the incentives of just publishing papers and being first author and such, because of those incentives, it does not select out people who have anti-collaborative, antagonistic tendencies. And I think it makes for worse science.
I think I heard you say, if given the opportunity, you think others would be in your place.
Yeah. I think growing up the way that I did was not unique. But I think that I got lucky in that my parents had heard about this particular, like, you know, white private high school and on a whim decided to send me there knowing that it would be like very isolating for me. That's a sacrifice. They made that sacrifice. That I'm sure that was a very heavy calculus to make. This trajectory was only enabled by the fact that I like happened to be like at the right, like in a very serendipitous way, at the right place at the right time. I would not have gone to Yale if I didn't hear about Questbridge by going on a tour at UVA. I would not have heard about the Baker Lab if my roommate's brother, who was an MD PhD student at the time, decided to not come down right before Christmas and then obliquely mention this dude, David Baker, in some random conversation with me. Like, it was just like a lot of these like kind of random events, right?
There was no grand plan.
There was no plan. I was truly just like chilling, like trying to figure out what was going on and what I was doing then. So I had no plan of getting here. And I think that, you know, if you ran my life trajectory like 1,000 times, I would have ended up here like maybe 2 or 3 times. It does not feel very likely. But I recognize because I have so much shared experience and background with so many different people, like there are a lot of like folks who grew up like me who like science and are nerds and do and like would pursue science with the correct mentorship and the correct opportunity. And that's something that bothers the hell out of me. That really bothers me. And I feel like they, like a lot of folks should be having these opportunities to do really cool science and get paid for their creativity. And it would also be nice if they didn't have to move halfway across the country to do so. To me, I mean, who knows? So yeah, I think that, you know, kind of dispelling this like notion of like the talented 10th, like there's like, I think a lot of people could do what we're doing. Like the power of like the Baker Lab isn't that anybody, any individual is like so brilliant that like nobody else can do what they're doing. I tell people all the time, like you put somebody else in this position and you give them the tools to thrive and they're going to come up with something crazy. I promise. And like, that's why the Baker Lab has done super well. And I don't think that I or any of my colleagues are phenomenally unique. I think we're all, a lot of us are pretty normal, you know? And I think that's really beautiful if we can get more folks from different backgrounds here. Like, they can also do cool stuff. And I think that's what this podcast highlights.
What's some advice you'd give to your younger self?
Keep working hard and keep caring. And that's something that I think I really learned from my dad, is like something that has propelled me forward. Like, even if I am not the smartest in the room, blah, 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 like I will work hard towards the end goal. And then caring about stuff, about relationships, about the quality of your work, just like actually investing, like pouring into it, just like dialing in for a little bit and like doing your diligence makes for just a way richer life. Like my relationships are so much richer because I care about them and I invest in them. My science is richer because I think about it and I spend some time, even if I'm frustrated, trying to figure out what's going on. My music has gotten better because I sit down and I analyze, like, why does this sound so terrible compared to what I'm hearing, right? And I think that's something that I'm really glad to have, like, had ingrained in me early, is just, like, you know, just care and, like, do it regardless of what people say. I think that's what makes me a nerd, for real, like, is that I care regardless.
Maybe we'll close with this. What's next for your research and what's next for you?
Oh, man, you catching me at a crossroads. I don't know. Right now, I'm signed up to go back to med school. And so you know, I'm going back to med school theoretically in March. The only thing that would stop me from going back to med school is if it were time to do the thing that I came out here to do. I came out here to start a company. I had an idea before I'd even heard about the Baker Lab that one could make nanoparticles for cellular delivery. And I didn't say it that way, but I was like, wouldn't it be cool if you could build these virus-like particles that you could package with drugs and protect those drugs from the body and get that drug to a cell type of interest? And then I realized that people were working on that in a variety of places, and one of the places was here. So that's what I'm working on right now. Making better, safer drug delivery vehicles so people have fewer side effects, so our drugs are more effective with fewer amount, with less of the drug needed, so that our drugs are cheaper. I would love to get that vision off the ground. That's what I'm working on, and one day, hopefully, inshallah, I'll be able to do so.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. It's been a pleasure having you part of this community, and I'm excited to see all the cool stuff you're going to do next. Thank you, Jeremy.
Yeah, thank you. This has been fun.
Thanks for listening to the Baker Lab podcast. I'm your host, Ian Hayden.
And I'm David Baker.
This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington School of Medicine. It was produced by Anisha Sehgal, Rithi Biswas, Nora McNamara-Bordwick, and me, with help from Roni Weissman, Joe Min, and Nathan Greenwood. Our intro music is by Kevin McLeal, and the rest of the music in this episode was made by Jeremy Sims. Please subscribe and leave a rating if you like the show, and we'll see you next time.